it became clear to me very quickly that this was not just going to be surface level work, that we were going to really be expected to dig deep and show vulnerability and own our mistakes and, you know, all of that good stuff, which in theory as a leader, I'm all about doing. But certainly in practice, when you're still within your first few months, if not weeks, it can be a little bit daunting to think about that you're going to just step in and immediately need to be that vulnerable.
That's Irina Pulitzer. She's the Vice President of Development Administration at the CHOP Foundation. She was new to the job when the opt-in learning program began. And like any new leader, she wanted to start the job on the right foot, which in many people's minds means being right.
You know, I had to do a little bit of like courageous conversations with myself about it's okay that I'm going to kind of be showing some of my messy beginning to others, and that's okay.
Being messy isn't something we often think should be part of the workplace. But to create culturally competent companies that respect people's humanity while promoting innovation, well, I'm here to share with you all. Then it's going to be messy. And that messiness is part of the journey. This is The Opt-In. I'm Aurora Archer. In this season of the podcast, we're taking a deep dive and looking at a multi-year DE&I partnership between The Opt-In and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also known as CHOP. We're taking you along a ride of our victories and also what we've learned along the way. This season makes a lot more sense in sequential order. So if you're starting here, let me encourage you to go back to our feed and start from episode 37, Why DE&I. In the last episode, you met more of our team here at The Opt-In, and you learned about the nuts and bolts behind our process. Today, we're going to be talking about what it takes for you to begin your personal as well as your company's cultural competency journey. We'll get into some of the challenges of this work and, quite honestly, how you can overcome them. One more thing. We know not everyone listens through to the very end of the credits. So let's do this up front. If you, like us, are super inspired by what you hear from the remarkable humans at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we invite you to please make a donation to the CHOP Foundation. Just go to chop.edu/giving. There are a few things that we've already covered in this season about what it takes to pull off an effective cultural competency program. Firstly, we know that executives must recognize the importance of cultural competency. And secondly, we know that once we have buy-in from the C-suite, we need much more than just lip service. We need to invest in cultural competency with time, with money, and a continuous commitment. The CHOP Foundation had all of these fronts covered when they embarked on their cultural competency journey with the opt-in.
We have an executive who is a Black female. And I don't say that for the pat answer of, oh, only a Black executive would be interested in diversity. But rather, she knows on probably a cellular level the importance of this work and prioritizes it in a way that for a lot of other people, it would be easy to give lip service to, but not know.
That's Irina Pulitzer again.
I am the Vice President of Development Administration at the CHOP Foundation. And so that basically means that I oversee all of the back office partners to our frontline fundraisers. And that includes our wonderful foundation culture team, which is the group under which our work with the opt-in took place and is continuing to take place.
Like Irina said, Monica Taylor Lottie, the executive vice president at the CHOP Foundation, had a fire in her belly. She was ready to define a new model of working that centered cultural competency skills across her entire organization. Plus, she was willing to put money where her mouth was. Irina puts it like this: cultural competency should
really be thought about as much as an investment in the future as thinking about what kind of new, you know, what's the new plant you need or what's the new technology that you need in order to stay successful. And, you know, we don't want to rest on our laurels. Well, this is the same kind of thing, but for our workforce and for our people.
But this program, the kind that talks about race honestly, needs much more than just buy-in to work. It needs the ongoing commitment from everyone, which means that leaders within the organization must lead their teams by example. They need to model the work. And this is especially critical for white leaders. So, Irina, in doing this work, we have spent some time talking about leadership and the importance that leadership plays in modeling the evolution of culture, the value of inclusion, the value of diversity. Can you talk about what that means to you, and specifically as it means to you as a leader and a white female leader?
I think one of the toughest aspects for a lot of white people coming into this work is a tremendous amount of fear. Of being afraid of saying the wrong thing, of being afraid to admit to where we have learned and grown, you know, and just of being perceived, you know, as inauthentic because of the fact that we're white. And I think it gets back in a lot of ways to, again, naming that duality, naming that tension and calling it out, both for yourself and for the people that you're working with, of like, I acknowledge this and I'm going to try to take these steps to mitigate that, but I'm also not going to let that be my reason for not participating or even trying.
One thing about the Opt-ins Learning Program is that having a bigger office doesn't excuse you from being a learning participant. Everybody is a learner. Executives, managers, and individual contributors alike delve into the material together, which is why it's so important for senior team members to model the work.
In thinking back on some of the things that we learned through our pod learning program, you know, through the journey together, towards the end, we started talking a lot more about white dominant culture and the aspect how that's permeated professionalism and notions of professionalism throughout, let's just say the US, I'm sure more broadly, but you know, how that's really gotten locked into our own perceptions in many cases of how we're expected to show up and how we're supposed to act. I kind of start thinking that this expectation that our leaders will come in and instantly know everything and be omnipotent and be very hierarchical and be very top-down, domineering, that kind of stuff, those are all, I think, elements of that white dominant culture and that kind of expectation. And so being willing to buck that trend and say, hey, I'm walking into this and I'm learning right alongside with you. You know, we're all learning together. The only difference is that I'm the one who's approving the purchase order, I guess, you know, but like other than that, we're all learning together on this journey. And I'm not afraid to show the spots that you likely may be far more expert than I am.
This kind of vulnerability as a leader within an organization means that mistakes are expected, they're reflected upon, and they're learned from. It's something that Katie Muller knows well.
I am going to opt in to being a visible and vocal and thoughtful model for this work, including curiosity, openness, self-reflection, and humility.
We've heard from Katie in the podcast before. She's the executive director of business operations at CHOP Foundation. She found out through trial and error the importance of modeling cultural competency.
When I was a learning participant myself in the program, I had recently been promoted and hadn't fully settled into what it meant to have my new title and my new team quite yet. And was going through this program with a member of our senior team who is another white woman. And she made a comment in a session that didn't sit right with me. uncomfortable. And I made a mental note to myself of, I'm going to follow up with her after this and talk about it. And then later that day or later that week, I got a call from somebody else who was in that session, who was a more junior staff person, a BIPOC staff person, who said, I was really disappointed in you for not saying anything in that moment. And you're a leader at this level in the organization now. And I need to see you modeling the behavior that we're working towards. And I remember sitting with that and receiving it and saying, on the one hand, yes, this person is absolutely right. And also sort of exploring the fact that my leadership style until that point, I would have very much characterized as sort of quiet and behind the scenes. I'm a person who like quietly gets things done and people might not always know what I'm up to. And it was a wake-up call for me of like, oh, I'm one of these leaders who I keep asking to step into the space and model. And the expectations of how I do that are changing and people are noticing. And so we had been having conversations at the senior leadership level above me about, hey, as white leaders, we're expecting you to go through the program first. We're expecting you to engage with it, ask questions, be vulnerable. And I will say for myself that I had this wake up moment of, oh, that's me too. I need to do that too.
Is it uncomfortable to mess up? Absolutely. Heck yes. Is it also valuable? Without a doubt, double fist down, yes. Making mistakes is part of the process to achieve something much, much bigger.
I think about how we have medical breakthroughs in innovation on the clinical side of CHOP. And I think that the foundation brings just as much imagination and innovation and commitment to the work that we do here. And so I want to meet the level of innovation that our clinicians have. I want to meet the level of innovation that the fundraisers have in the work that we're doing around culture. But for me, it's life can have more joy and connection and justice. And this is one way of making that reality just a little bit closer to being the truth.
So let's recap. What we need from leaders to pull off a real cultural competency program is executive buy-in, financial resources, and leadership modeling. But there's also something else we need from leaders to make this work.
When you hire a consultant, you are still going to have to do some administrative work. My name is Peter Andrew Danzig. I use they, them pronouns, and I identify as a genderqueer Latinx person living with an invisible disability. I am a trauma survivor, proudly, and here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, I serve in the role as the director of foundation culture here for our philanthropic unit at the hospital.
Peter has been a crucial player in the cultural competency journey at CHOP. They bring their background in both trauma therapy and the arts into their work. And as a senior team member in CHOP's cultural competency journey, they understand the everyday work it takes to carry out a program of this caliber.
I have a staff of 200, and I am not beyond pinging them individually and saying, am I accommodating your learning style? Is this invitation on your calendar? If you want it to be, what do you need from me? What doesn't work? Because guess what? If you're asking your consultant to spend all of the time on just the IT portion and you don't want to deal with it, which guess what? I don't either. I don't like it. I have the highest regard for people in IT and IS. You have all of my respect. I could never do it. But if you think that you're not going to do it, then you're never getting to action.
Spreadsheets, emails, reminder phone calls, nudges, they're all part of the job. But don't get me wrong, Peter isn't just some cog in the machine. They do these everyday tasks because they know that's what needs to happen to help foster real change and transformation within an organization.
And I think that my purpose as a leader, my true purpose is directly linked to the ways that I see the world, in that I want a more equitable, I want an acknowledgement of diversity, I want engagement with socialization of difficult conversations. And so for me, the big why in this work is truly what it means when we talk about the symbolic table. I look at it as my life's work.
And this kind of project needs people like Peter. So go find you a Peter who is committed for the long haul.
You see it in the movies all the time. The wheels, the cogwheels are going, and the antagonist and the protagonist are at their last bit of the fight. And the way to win is to take a big stick and push it in to the cogwheel and hope it'll make the machine blow up. If you read or you listen or you engage in a program and you take it from education to unlearning to actual action, those three steps, they don't happen in a year. I'm letting you all know, hold on to your consultants for a good 5 to 6. Don't go for the 1 year. Don't go for the 2. Go for the 5 to 6. Stop trying to measure the KPIs in 2 years. That's not where the meat of the data is going to give you what you need. But if you could think about throwing the stick in the cogwheel, my gosh, that's what the Marvel movies are based on. It's that heated moment of, will I or won't I? Will I let them win?
And today, we're not going to let these systems that prevent all people from accessing opportunity, innovation, and deeper connection win. Okay, my friends, I know that was a lot. We got into the real work that it will take for any company to take on a cultural competency program that works. And as we've shared, it's not all rainbows and butterflies. This work can be hard, and there are some real challenges that come with it. So we want to share with you one of the biggest challenges we faced during the learning program at CHOP. And we also want to bring you the lessons that we learned so that together we can all do better. It's probably not surprising that one of the biggest challenges was talking about race in a multiracial space. At the opt-in, we have people across all racial lines in conversation with each other. Because if we don't understand each other, we cannot change ourselves.
We're all affected. Even white people, we're all affected by whiteness, white supremacy, and, you know, in my other world, and then capitalism. And that, like, then you can build off of all the systems. And that's why it's not just, oh, but I have like this friend or I was nice to this person. It's like, that's not the reason we are doing this. It's because people are affected in multitude of ways.
That's Dominique Corniture. She is one of the younger staff members on the CHOP Foundation's team and works as an assistant development officer in planned giving. And as one of the few Black women on the team, she had a particular experience participating in the opt-in learning program. So were there any thoughts that you had when you're like, oh, we're going to have this conversation at work?
I'm a Black woman born, raised in the United States, and I assumed it'd be pretty elementary, I guess, based on my lived experience. That doesn't mean it's not important, and it doesn't mean that it's not important to learn in like a systemic way. Like, there's lived experience, but there's also like the knowledge of reading, hearing from others, and again, just broadly learning about your place within all of those structures. So I think that's what I initially thought. It's just like what it would look like. And I knew it would be random cohorts. So also gave me the opportunity to learn my coworkers in a different way, in a safe space where we knew the conversations wouldn't leave those virtual spaces. I think that was also like a piece too, that I get to, outside of what maybe my expectation is for the learning, I'm learning from other people and how they're shaped around like the overall system too.
And so what was your experience as a Black woman in a multiracial learning environment?
I think I ended up in a cohort that wasn't as diverse as regards race. It was interesting. I think I definitely didn't like speak up as much because I think a lot of it was like, I know this already. Like, there's no response that I really have other than like, yes, that is the truth. I don't think it was good. I don't think it was bad. I think it was just like, I kind of felt myself maybe like taking a step back, probably.
And so let's talk about that step back, because I think that sometimes this is maybe harder for our white colleagues, our white race colleagues, to understand that as Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and certainly as a Black woman, we've been having these conversations for a really long time.
Right.
And yet we find ourselves in structures, systems, and certainly corporate America, when you look at the diversity that exists in corporate America, which is still in many cases in the single digits, depending on which level. It can be energy consuming. It can be frustrating.
Yes.
And dare I say, at times disappointing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I don't want to come off as if I'm saying like I felt silenced. It's more of what you're saying, where it just felt like energy was a little exhausting, probably is the word. So it's like, and I felt like colleagues were very, specifically other white colleagues, were energetic about doing that extra lift. So it felt good that there was that give and take. It's not that I felt like I couldn't speak. So I thought the space felt really safe to do step in, step out, give people a chance to speak up and when to take a step back.
Dominique entered the learning program with an open mind and a deep desire for change. But being in a predominantly white space, talking about race meant something very different to her than some of her white colleagues. And here's the thing. Dominique extended so much grace towards her colleagues throughout the process. And I can speak personally as a woman of color who's been in all white spaces talking about race. It can be draining, sometimes even re-traumatizing. We all have a breaking point. And while Dominique didn't reach hers during the opt-ins learning program, there were other participants who did. It's a challenge Peter Danzig experienced as a leader at the CHOP Foundation.
It's so, I look back now and I'm like, oh, it was so glaring for me now, but not then, was that I couldn't have known what our BIPOC populations would be experiencing during the racial literacy cohort trainings. But I had to hear our staff when they said, like, I can't sit through this training, this part of it, this one day. There's 12 sessions. Let's say for this exercise today, Black and African American identifying participants talking about a portion of historical racism. That day, to get through their job, they just said, I think I need to take my miss so that I can opt in to the next session, but staying here is not going to be good for my mental health for this particular day. Most organizations would have said, you have to do all 12, and if you don't, you failed the program. Our stumble was that we pushed a little in saying, well, let's try to hear, experience the unlearning together, and give you the space to call people in. Worked for some, didn't work for others. What I've learned now is to think about my places of intentionality of putting everyone in the room together at the table, and then also the intentionality of unlearning spaces for both populations, for all populations, because we have our own unlearning within. As we do the intersectional work, when we get out of racial literacy, many of my staff have said to me, oh, now I'd like to say that, like, being on the other side, somebody doesn't want to be in a training with me because I have to unlearn my microaggressions towards LGBTQIA plus people, or pronouns, or people said to me, like, I myself sometimes, I'm like, I can't sit for an hour explaining my gender identity to you. I think we all get there. The racial literacy portion was the biggest stumble for us because that is the biggest systemic machine that has been built to keep us separate. And yet sometimes we also needed to be separate for our mental health on certain days. So it's like the system is meant to keep us away, but also sometimes we have to use the exact thing that is meant to do in a way to keep ourselves safe. It is such an odd dichotomy there that, like, you might have to step out and not be at the table that day to keep yourself protected.
It's counterintuitive, but sometimes you need to opt out in order to opt in.
And That's my invitation, corporate America, nonprofits, or whoever might be listening, is when somebody tells you something, instead of trying to reinforce so you can check their name on the box as participation, listen, trust their story, believe in their reasoning. Create a culture where you can trust in people's stories, listen to them, and believe in their reasoning. I beg you. That's when you get the participation.
Can you hear us in the back? Trust people's stories. In the Opt-ins Cultural Competency Program, we meet people where they are and we honor what they need. We should all push ourselves because growth comes with struggle. But that doesn't mean we need to throw away our mental health. This is why mindfulness is such an important practice at the Opt-in. It's also why we have identity-based small group coaching and make one-on-one coaching available as well. Look, if you want to make change, there's just going to be some growing pains. It's just part of the process. They are hard, but like what we've learned in this episode, we can overcome them. And it's so, so worth it. But don't just take my word for it.
The more I've explored the hard stuff, the more I've let myself felt, if I use like kind of bittersweet as the two ends of the spectrum of experience, when I lean into the bitter, I let myself look at it, the stuff that hurt, either I did or was done to me, I'm then able to experience greater levels of like joy and gratitude and expression. So it's like the deeper I allow myself to go, the higher I can go in some of these other experiences.
That's next time. You've been listening to The Opt-In. I'm Aurora Archer. If you are enjoying the season, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you can, leave us a rating or a review. It helps others find us. And please share with your friends, colleagues, and absolutely your bosses. Music from this episode is by Jordan McCree. The Opt-In is produced by Rachel Ishikawa and Colin Lacey. And our theory of change is co-created by Colleen Philbin. Inspired by what you heard? We invite you to make a donation to the CHOP Foundation. Go to chop.edu/giving. Thank you so much for listening.